Thank you for that lovely introduction. Thank you all for being here. I'm very glad to have arrived in San Francisco, finally. And I'm going to read first from my newest book, which is called Ocular Proof. And it's a phrase that comes from Shakespeare, from Othello. I was very interested in the ways in which photographs prove and lie at the same time, the way they are documents and also ways in which they can warp the truth, and also ways in which I, because I've lived with photographs for most of my adult life, particularly 19th century black and white photographs, the ways in which I can see parts of my life sort of folded into photographs. So some of these are pretty straightforward, and I'm going to start with a very straightforward one. And then more of them have to do with the ways in which, while looking at a photograph, I have other thoughts. Can you hear me? I'm wired up, but yes, can you hear me? Good. Okay. So the first one is called Paris, 1926, at Jay, who was a great photographer who took photographs of Paris. Many of his photographs are of ordinary streets and ordinary street fronts, storefronts, and so forth. If you don't know his photographs, I recommend them. Photography, born in inaugural mist. At Jay, getting it by not getting it, in the flare behind plane trees, in the street lamp's dot of light, that could be anything, but it's the Quai d'Anjou, not an error in printing. To say it's actual light isn't it either, or an actual tree, or what sort of tree, and could one walk over and touch it? In that twilight zone between seeing and not seeing. Men on the street blurring their shirt fronts and pulling a cart blown by wind and emulsion past the door of the corner building, cognac, rum, and kirsch, where a man in stone is fixing a stone shoe. Paris, in the exact year it was. Take two. Does staring into the black and white contours of a photo enable a rapprochement with the unreality of one's own life, a way to see peculiarity as a back staircase in an old house in a city so memorably far, dark, the stairs lacking undulation, items strewn across a landscape, fixed and determined, the borders of history and frame set, and watching her feet going up and down, counting the risers that are always 16, despite the deformation of dreams. Always scuffed, smelling of dust, the taste of a local architect influenced by city regulations and his sense of propriety, and then turning the page to an image of the purported documents of an ordinary scene. A few weeds wavering in the foreground and the jagged outlines against a sky, a 7 p.m. time of day, summer, a dry rush of air, and a cutout of one's own days called up. The bereavement left on the stairs to be carried up when you go. The first poem in the book is called A Blurry Photograph. And I was talking to someone the other day who said, I actually think that the ones that are blurry are the best. So this is called A Blurry Photograph. And it takes place actually, or the imagined scene is in a kitchen where someone is putting dishes away in cupboards. A Blurry Photograph. The tree azalea overwhelms evening with its scent, defining everything and the endless fields. Walking away, suddenly it slices off and is gone. The visible object blurs open in front of you. The outline of a branch folds back into itself, then clarifies. Just as you turn away, and the glass hardens into glass as you go about taking care of things abstractedly, one thing shelved after another, as if they were already in the past, needing nothing from you until smashing itself on the tile floor, the present cracks open the aftermath of itself. You have probably seen these, but if you haven't, there are 19th century photographs of grieving families that were taken by shyster photographers in which the ghosts of the dead stand behind them. So these were ways in which photography manipulated the truth, obviously, and they superimposed prints on one another. And so this poem refers in part to the kind of ghostly nature of photography, not only these ones in which there are purported specters, but that way in which everything that you're looking at is already gone, dead, as it were, something that you can't get hold of. And I think it's in part because I'm so enamored of the melancholy, I think it's in part why I like photography, because you're looking at something that's not available, that's gone, ghosts. That blur in the corner of the photograph in the hills which fold over on themselves in infinite regress when witnesses are looking elsewhere. On the blue steps, a child made her way slowly and with specific intent. Kertész photographed stairs extending past the small figure and out of sight. In ghost photographs, the see-through specters stand behind the bereaved. They saw it, they believed, a beloved walking in from another world. In the hours spent on the blue stairs, pages came alive, and there was no time until interrupted. Baudelaire worried lest photography impinge on the sphere of the intangible and imaginary. And I'm going to read the little quotation that's at the bottom. This was a work that I did that had actually an enormous amount of research in it. I don't know if those of you who are in workshops or thinking about writing have done research, but one of the things I like to do when I'm working on a book is to actually just read a lot of things that are about something that's bothering me or something that I'm thinking about. And so there's a kind of quality of this book, I think, that takes you in and out of my poems and then into quotations. I'm not going to read all of them, but here's one of them. In the late 1850s, Gustave Le Gray pioneered a way of combining two negatives to create a print that showed a magical combination of sea or land and sky that had, in fact, never existed, hoping to evoke the visceral emotion of Wuthering Heights. For those of you who've read Wuthering Heights. But anyway, it's that way of putting things together that fills you with emotion, but it's not true. It was something that he composed. The picture plane. The actual world pushes a shrub of ceanothus, stained of its purple, up against the picture plane, a messy splay of branches, as though missing all the cues, it moved in close, breathing stale air. Some child has put sticky fingers in your hair, is sitting on the edge of your coat, is the child whose awkward stance is your own shoes, pointing pigeon-toed in a photograph you remember the awkward itch of. Also called California lilac, the plant thrives on neglect, the imperfect conditions of hot wind sweeping across deserts in a movie of so much violence, the children live on it, sensing a breakdown that's already occurred, their games dwarfed by a range of San Gabriel Mountains, almost indistinguishable and only seemingly benign. One of the photographers that I was particularly taken with, and it's because he did many photographs of the part of California that I live in, which is the southern part of California, with a lot of views that are not picturesque, but scruffy, blasted, hot, dusty, and badly arranged. And his name is Robert Adams. And he took these photographs, and I'm very, very fond of them because that's the scenery that I recognize. I remember when I first came to Los Angeles being shocked that there were these kind of scruffy dirt fields next to high rises, and the fact that they were juxtaposed seemed odd to me. But in any case, this is called No Sky, after Robert Adams. Again, in Los Angeles, the sky tends to be a kind of backdrop of white. It is so hot. Anybody from LA here? Yes, so you know what I mean. It's just that. So this is called No Sky. No sky, a gray backdrop merely, and below, the scraggle of dusty fronds, the scrub oak and scrub jay, whose abrasive noises sharpen in response. Shadows proliferate in deep furrows. No sky. Merely a scrim registering conical thrusts, a heightened flurry, and outlines of branches, the dead ones slowly petering out. Magnificent ruin, the cut through the field, blasted chaparral. An unvoiced series of sentences without articulation, gray shapes, formulating a syntax loosening and then tightening from edge to edge. The frame sets a border down from which a thin straggle hangs at random, like purposeful intrusion. And the interstate in the title, missing from the photograph itself, merely a dry riverbed, the density of shadows trapped in the confusion of bush and bush-like tree. Except from higher up than the rest, its thin trunk arched against no sky, colorless, less often remarked upon, appositely emotionless these days, a relic, like the fan palm living at the edge of water. This is called the photographic object. One thing that interests me, and it was particularly true in a book that I wrote called Transfer of Qualities, is the way in which people and things or people and objects exchange qualities with one another. It's a quotation from Henry James, and I'm just interested in that way in which the edges of things blur enough so that there's a kind of crossover. And for me in this book, there was that kind of crossover between the speaker in the poem and the photograph itself. The photographic object. It's too close or too far to be seen at the fogged horizon. My balance is off, clearing away the brush at the side of the photograph, tying up bundles to be carted away and pruning what's left. What, for God's sakes, is that roundish bit on top of a shrub over there, branches any good wind might break, asymmetry in disheveled light? It's either dense shadow or a tree, either downhill or a camera tilt, ironic or a story hidden in what's seen. What was I seeing in the dusty leaves and skin and endless hours, even afterward, calm, astringent, in the still black and white? So I feel as if I'm telling you about photographer, but there's a great photographer named Brassai who took a lot of photographs of Paris, and he took a number of them at night. And so this is called Brassai's Night Photographs. Photographing Paris at night, Brassai wanted to be raised to the level of object. And this is a quotation. The world is richer than I. The wall speaking to him in graffiti chipped from a childish drawing of interlocking hearts, only seeming symbolic, only seeming impossible. On such days, reification attracts as the whole city spreads out before you. Metempsychosis, not from flesh to flesh, but from where he stood, his large camera before him, into bridges across the Seine. They're gorgeous photographs. This is another one based on a photograph by Robert Adams. And it's called Elegy, and is about the, it's about death altogether, but there's a particular person whom I knew as a young woman who died, and he shows up in the middle of the poem, and that's what I mean about the way in which things that I remember and photographs are in a kind of dialogue, I suppose, with one another. Elegy and a photograph by Robert Adams. Headlights light up a weed, then a cone of blossoms lifting off into shadows, driven by the demarcation of time. And they stay with us as we go forward in undifferentiated dark. Part of the trouble is an echo of objects just past and those about to arrive. They fade out slowly, those conical bright shapes out from the field and across the dashboard. He had walked into, fallen into the truck crossing the road. Later, he had fallen into the water near the pier. Earlier, he had decided or he hadn't decided, or it had shaped itself around him. It's hard to see sunflowers in the dark, but the dark center surrounded by gray petals is immediately clear, despite shadows, despite tricks played on the eye. It seems more than obvious that nothing particular is about to happen. When the painters paint the white line down the middle of the road, do they not see how it shines in the near dark, nearly upon us? And I'll read you another quotation, and this one is from Roland Barthes. Now, everywhere in the street, the cafe, I see each individual under the aspect of ineluctably having to die, which is exactly what it means to be mortal. And no less obviously, I see them as not knowing this to be true. And that's from his book, Camera Lucida, about photography. I want to read you some new poems, so I'm just going to read a couple more from this book. This one is called Philadelphia, PA, 1967. And it's a photograph by Lee Friedlander, who was who is probably best known for taking pictures in which the shadow of the photographer shows up in the photograph. So you're very aware that he's standing there, he's taking the picture, and that's his photograph. So he has a number of books like that, and also a great one about TVs. But I'm going to read this one. Philadelphia, PA, 1967. All giant elbows, forcing his way into his own photo, his shadow overtakes the doorway, the camera outline lost just above the doorknob against which a chair is shoved. A torso looming in a shrinking room, the exact shadow of the inexact, shapeless, a barrier to anyone's coming in or out. Yet walking seamlessly through the closed door in a well-worn disguise as oneself, here again, gone again, winged elbows of refusal against solidity. A game repeated over and over, testing the tactile world, a tentative, then harder push, as if film could capture that final fade into a blank wall. He himself refused any information but the date of when it was made, so he wouldn't talk about his own photographs. The newer poems that I'm going to read to you, although the book is recent, I'm working on a series that I think, I'm muddling around in it anyway, I think that it's mostly about silence. And about the hearing of things and what happens in the silence after. And it started by thinking about Wallace Stevens and the kinds of things that he said about the blackbird, which he liked better, the blackbird whistling or just after. And that's where it started. And then the poems got more and more disquieted. So instead of being about quiet, they seem to be more about disquiet. So I'm going to read you a few of these. This one's called An Alternate Universe. It shatters you in an alternate universe of everything exactly the same corridors into which darkness echoes its own expansion, the fretful beforehand as a dull prod. See their severance, see their binding, see their overabundance of, yet exactly as the most ordinary of the ordinary daily duplicities, how you awoke and found that ruin was the coin of the realm, arcane vocabulary and a tone of stridency close to the inconsolable at the ends of its fragility, slabs forced into hillsides to keep from sliding, a sickly algae spread over the watercolors in ponds as ruin grew out of it, the biologically determined now determining its own, and hunger under every stone. These are stairs. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but sometimes you come to the top of a long thing of stairs, flight of stairs, and you just look down and you realize, oh my God, these are stairs. I mean, it just goes off into space. So I stood there at the top of my stairs, and this is what happened. A return of puzzles tangled in wallpaper patterns, deer-like antlers in the corners of carpets, repeats in wool, in newsprint, the ritual hours of darkness, pauses at the top of stairs, the necessary reminder, these are stairs, two figures locked in the friction of each other's ways, the room whitewashed over, the diagram of a tree arranged with its adjectives drooping, bafflements of years as chalky liquid turns cobalt blue, turns tenmaku, breaks into bands of brown and black, fingers cramped with what they've become, rents too high, according to the economist, half of wages, according to my reading, the problems of percentages, all's more than mere sounds, more than glaze colors, as her unpaid hours extend, louder the child, heavier up the stairs, one foot, another. I forgot to say, which I might have said before I read this to you, that in other parts of my life, I go to a ceramic studio and work with pottery and glazes and so on. So they showed up somehow in this poem out of the murk. And you put these glaze colors on pots that go into kilns, they look kind of muddied gray and they come out blue or black or red or green or whatever. It's an amazing kind of transformation. Belonging to whom? Who belongs to whom and where as the bird's noise to some shrub near the ribs, under the third branch from the ground, hooked to wings it seems to have flown, belonging now to the pure form of light in which nothing makes any sound, just skirmish in the dirt, half-hearted footnotes recalling lists of names on the blank page of a book, belonging once to others, lost in cities, never belonging anywhere, documenting everywhere as rapidly as mania could manage, where belonging might mean billions offshore, percolated, pretended, where infestations of insects destroy elms, libraries. She, not owning even the shoes she wore, the skirt wrapped over words and creeds. Whom do they belong to, these birds, sounding out their directional language, unknown, unlabeled, belonging to the yet unpropertied air? And I'm going to close with a poem called After... dot, dot, dot. And I think, no, I was going to say ceramics showed up here too, but they don't. Okay. After. What was I doing on the floor, rag in hand, and how many times? The stain of underglaze, rust on the underside of a porcelain sink. And it happens time over time as the pale color of sun rises in her canvases, just under the surface, but coming as if there were an after in the dawn. We try to gather it on paper, spread it on bodies still asleep, the moment of knowing what even the splay of an arm will bring. After is what we have to live with, and it moves itself back and forth in some mechanized brainwave, unable to stop what was, what will be, as when silence ravishes the sidewalk, down the street, a back and forth body pulling time, pushing it, a box with wheels and filled with bits of bark and leaves, where after ghosts itself on the present. Take it, amplify it, see it coming. So it said we all dream of falling, unexceptionally, a projected future tense, each in a category we all belong to. Thank you.